Good morning. This is Dr. Susanna J. Dodgson, publisher of Medical Journal of Therapeutics Africa, mjota.org. And I want to talk to you today about Nobel Prizes for diabetes. You can read a lot of resources on mjota.org. There's some pages on diabetes. On drsusanna.org, I have included a lot of pages on Nobel Prizes after two things happened earlier this year. First of all, Wangari Maathai, professor, doctor, member of parliament, Wangari Maathai died at the end of September, and she was the first African woman awarded the Nobel Prize. She was a scientist, but she was awarded it for peace because she planted trees all over Africa. But she was more than that, and you can read a lot about her and watch videos on drsusanna.org. The week she was buried in her native Nairobi, three women were awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace. Two of them were African. They came from Liberia. And so on drsusanna.org, you can read a lot about them too. Now, in the past week, the Nobel Prize was awarded in Sweden and in Oslo. Now, the Nobel Prize has a very interesting history. It all came from the fortune of one man, Alfred Nobel. And he had a jolt. He was happily reading the paper one morning, and he saw his obituary in 1888. And this shocked him so much, he decided that having patents, inventing things, being an extraordinarily successful researcher, entrepreneur, businessman, that just wasn't enough. What he needed to do was create a prize. I love the way visionaries think. They don't think like we do. They think with vision. Here's this man suddenly thinking that his life was useless, and he funds the richest prize in the history of the world. Now, how much money was there? Well, first of all, it was controversial to the start, and it had to be approved. His will had to be approved by the Swedish government. And very symbolically, the first prize was awarded in 1901, so right at the beginning of the 20th century. A very, very clean starting a prize in the 1 year of the century. The first prize, I don't remember how much, I didn't find out, I didn't look up how much the first prize was, but how much was in the fund was 31 million Swedish crowns. And Swedish crowns are about 8 per dollar, US dollar, something like that. So 31 million Swedish crowns is 4.5 US dollars. So that's all he had. That's all they had to start off with in 1897, 1901, when the prize was first awarded. Now, how much do they get? Well, if you win a Nobel Prize all by yourself, and the three women who were awarded a prize this year for peace, they had to split the full amount. But the full amount now is 10 million Swedish krona, which is $1.5 million. Now, how did 4.5 million US dollars entirely in the pot end up being $1.5 million for one person? And there's five prizes. There's medicine, there's physics, there's chemistry, there's peace. And now there's, and since the late 60s, there's also been economic science. So, well, according to the Swedish side, and I've spent some time in Sweden, Alfred Nobel said not only did he want a prize to be awarded, but he wanted his money to be invested exceedingly wisely. And that's really what's happened. So more than anything else, although it's fabulous that brilliant people are being given prizes every year, the first lesson is invest prudently. Because if you invest prudently, you just end up with buckets and buckets and buckets of money. So today we're going to be talking about diabetes. And we're particularly going to be talking about the prize in medicine and physiology. And the first prize in medicine and physiology was awarded in 1901. For dysentery. The first prize was awarded for dysentery. And the second prize in 1902 was actually awarded for malaria. And what is this telling you? The first disease was dysentery. Second disease was malaria, and people figuring out treatments for these diseases. This is telling you how important these diseases were. Now, the first prize awarded for diabetes was not awarded until 1925, but we'll get to that. Let me talk to you a little bit about diabetes first of all. Diabetes is an ancient disease. The diabetes we're particularly interested in is the more common form, which is type 2, which is type 1, type 2 diabetes mellitus. That's what the disease is called now. But in 1900, when the Nobel Prizes were first awarded, there was only one diabetes, and it was called diabetes mellitus. There was only one diabetes mellitus, and it was a wasting disease. And it was called diabetes mellitus because the urine is sweet and has a honey-like odor, because what's happening is the body has lost its ability to properly metabolize sugar. So the sugar, glucose, simple carbohydrates are all being dumped out in the urine. And it can kill very, very rapidly. So Which is what was happening. If you had a diagnosis of diabetes and you were a kid, you could just waste away. You just have copious amounts of urine, and you're just getting thinner and thinner and thinner. And within a month, you can be dead. Now, of course, that's true today, too, if you don't get treatment. But what Banting and Best discovered in a lab in Canada was that if you can give people insulin, you can keep them alive. So that's what they did. They isolated this amazing substance from dogs and gave it to a child and injected it. And the person lived. Now, what's really interesting about them being awarded the prize in 1925 is that it created enormous controversy, which is still we're still hearing about today. The prize was awarded to Dr. Banting and Dr. McLeod. And Dr. McLeod apparently just walked into the lab occasionally, but he had nothing at all to do with the research. I've seen this in a... I remember when I was in Freiburg in a lab, an inner medicine at the Humboldt University in 1986. And anyone doing research and anyone publishing, the name of the professor who was the head of the department was automatically on this publication, and he didn't so much as set foot in the lab. And from what I understand, he may have read the manuscript or maybe not. But this is a very common practice. And it seems like the Nobel Prize Committee in this case just didn't do their research properly, which is surprising. Because the Nobel Prize Committee is very good at doing research into the work that's been done, because you know, they take it very, very seriously. You can just see how the prize has grown over the years, how seriously they really take it. But it was... But there's a lot of really extraordinary things about the prize in 1925. One thing was that the research was done the year the prize was awarded. That couldn't happen today. The other thing, too, was that the research was done at all. If you wanted to do the sort of research that was done then, which is isolating a product from an animal and injecting it into a child, you would have to go through so many committees, ethics committees. You'd have to go through the Food and Drug Administration to get approval for a clinical trial. There'd be a lot of things stopping you. But those were the Wild West days of research, where suddenly the 20th century was on us. There was access to all kinds of equipment. There was access to communication, telephones. People could talk to each other. People could get information. There was really nothing stopping them. Other prizes in... There's a wonderful list. A very great resource for Nobel Prizes is the Nobel Prize website, which is nobelprize.org. If you're a medical writer who's listening to this in order to get some tips about medical writing, I can tell you that nobelprize.org is a wonderful database for information about science that worked spectacularly. If you go to the nobelprize.org, you can click on Nobel Prize in Medicine, and there's a list of all the Nobel laureates in physiology and medicine. And it's really a list of advances in medical science in the 20th century. It's just absolutely spectacular. Occasionally, I'm sorry, I said 1925. 1925, no Nobel Prize was awarded. The prize that was awarded to Frederick Grant Banting and John James Richard McLeod was in 1923. But you see, no prize was awarded in 1925. No prize was awarded in 1921. And no prizes were awarded in the First World War years, which was 1915, 16, 17, 18. And the same thing happened too in the Second World War. No prizes were awarded at the beginning of the Second World War. In 1940, 1941, 1942. But then they came back spectacularly and awarded the Nobel Prize in 1943, 1944, 1945. So there are reasons not to award the prize. First of all, is that the committee looks around and says, my God, no one's done anything useful this year. And the other thing that can happen is the committee could look around and say, my God, we're being bombed. We can't award the Nobel Prize. And so that would certainly be a disincentive. In the not only did we have the First and Second World Wars in the 20th century, but we also had a major worldwide depression in 1929 when investments collapsed, fortunes were lost, people were jumping out of windows, but the Nobel Prize Committee invested very, very wisely. You look at the lists of the Nobel Prizes and you see how the money has grown and grown and grown. You know that no one put anything in a risky investment, which I just think it's spectacular. I love the Nobel Prizes. I don't know if you're getting that. I just think it's just something that's absolutely worked. And the Nobel Prize Committee will give people prizes to encourage them to do good work. This certainly happens in the Nobel Peace Prize, which is actually awarded in Norway. All the other Nobel Prizes are awarded in Sweden, and that's, I understand, because Norway used to belong to Sweden and something like that. Okay, well, the next Nobel Prize in insulin, diabetes, was awarded in 1947. And this was awarded to... Let's get that. I'm scrolling down here. 1947 was the next one. And... this was to the first time a prize was won by a woman, Gertie Corey, Carl Corey, and Bernardo Jose. So the Nobel Prize in 1947 was split. It was divided in half. Half went to the Coreys for their discovery of the course of the catalytic conversion of glycogen, which, of course, is a build-up of glucose. And the other half went to Alberto Husse for his discovery of the part played by the hormone of the anterior pituitary lobe in the metabolism of sugar. Now, this is all about sugar metabolism, and sugar metabolism is the problem in diabetes. This is not a direct Nobel Prize for diabetes research, but it's still very interesting. And I'll certainly have the link of this on MJOTA. All these links will be posted on MJOTA. And you can read about it. And you can read there. You can read their biographies. And you can also read the speeches. The NobelPrize.org site is exceedingly organized, so you can actually read the speech, and it's in Spanish. So if you can speak Spanish, you can read Bernardo Jose's speech. But that's another thing, too. Prizes are given to they weren't just given to American researchers or British researchers, which it seems like. They're given to people from all over the place. And very rarely are they ever given to anyone Swedish. Okay, well, the next time a Nobel Prize was awarded for anything connected to diabetes was in 1977. Although, I must say, Sir Hans Krebs was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1953. And Sir Hans Krebs discovered all kinds of biological cycles, like the Krebs cycle and the urea cycle, which is what I worked on when I was in research. In fact, I even worked in the same lab where he had worked before he was kicked out of Germany for being Jewish. And that was pretty incredible. Except that I really wasn't working in the same lab because, by mistake, at the end of the Second World War, the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, had bombed the hospital where I was working and reduced it to rubble and dust. And the Germans, being incredibly enterprising, found the blueprint for the hospital and rebuilt it exactly. So I was in the same airspace where Sir Hans Krebs had discovered the urea cycle, but the building pieces were new. I just thought that was amazing. No wonder I married a German and produced two German children. And the German I married was a descendant, was a close relative of another Nobel laureate, who was Otto Loewi, but that's another story. So Sir Hans Krebs, after he was kicked out for being Jewish, he ended up in England, and he was first in Sheffield. And he actually was in Sheffield in 1940, when my mother was a young physician from Ireland, and she was working in the same hospital. Now, my mother's been dead a number of years, but I remember asking her, did she know Hans Krebs? Did she ever meet him? And she didn't remember ever meeting him. Of course not. She was too busy being a young female doctor during the war when all the male doctors were off working in the troops. She was working 20 hours a day, pretty much. And she wasn't about to be running into any German physiologists, which I thought was a shame. I thought that would be a wonderful link. I've written a short story about that. It's very nice. And I had her meeting him. And because you can do that in fiction, that you can't do in real life. So that's the Hans Krebs. Let's get on to the next one of interest, which was in 1977. And in 1977, three people won the Nobel Prize. And this time, it was another woman, Rosalind Jallow. So this was split. It was divided in half. Now this time, the men got half, and the woman got the other half. Now why they split it in half like this is because the Nobel Prize Committee looks at two different things. They've decided that they can't choose between the discoveries. So the team that makes one discovery gets half, and the team that makes the other discovery gets the other half. And this time, the team of one half was just one person, Rosalind Jallow, and the other team was two. So in 1977, the prize was divided, one half to Roger Guillemin and Andrew Shelley for their discoveries concerning the peptide hormone production of the brain, and the other half to Rosalind Jallow for the development of radioimmune assays of peptide hormones. Okay, so what's the key here? Peptide hormone. And what is a peptide? And what is a peptide hormone? Well, a peptide hormone is insulin. Insulin is a very small peptide hormone. It's a tiny little peptide hormone. So, as you would expect, for a hormone that has to run around the body, get produced very quickly, run around the body, interact with cell membranes so glucose can get inside the cells, and then vanish. It's got to be gone. Insulin, when it's not being used, is dangerous. You need to get rid of it. So it has to be very small, and nothing could be smaller and more easily self-destructive than a peptide hormone. This is, insulin is a recyclable hormone. Now, in diabetes, if you have too much insulin, you can go into a diabetic coma. And that's why. You don't want too much going around. So this is what they discovered. Rosalind Jallow discovered how to detect peptide hormones, is really what it was. And we'll talk about that some other time, because we're running out of time now. We're nearly ready to stop. The last Nobel Prize of interest to us was in 1989, and this was given to Frederick Fanger for sequencing. It was given in 1989 for sequencing DNA, but this was his second Nobel Prize. He won a Nobel Prize earlier on for sequencing insulin. I think it was in 1958. But anyway. But we can talk about sequencing proteins and sequencing DNA later. But I just wanted to give you now. This is Dr. Susanna J. Dodgson. My website is mjoda.org, drsusanna.org. What I've talked about today, you can find resources about that on these sites. And where when you're listening to this on drsusanna.org, you can link to. In future episodes, we'll be talking about other things of interest to medical writers and to readers of medical journals, Therapeutics Africa, which is dedicated to talking about things of interest to African communities and things that are happening in African communities. We do not yet have a woman scientist who's African, who has won a Nobel Prize in medicine. Let's hope that will happen very soon. Goodbye, and God bless you, and thank you so much for listening.